It's Friday, and welcome to another edition of the Zogby Report, Real and Unscripted. I'm John, and I'm here again with my son and partner at Zogby Strategies, Jeremy. Hi, Jer, how are you?
Hey, good. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. So we have a special guest this week, and I'm really very pleased to welcome former senator, longtime senator from Connecticut, Joe Lieberman, as our guest. Hi, Senator, how are you?
John, I'm good. It's good to be with the family. I love the fact that you and Jeremy are doing this together. Really, it's great.
Well, thank you. Briefly, for those who may not know, and frankly, I don't know who doesn't know, but you've had over 40 years of elected office at local, state, and national levels, four-term U.S. Senator from the state of Connecticut. You've always been regarded as a centrist and a moderate and a legislative leader. You were a principal in the sponsorship and enactment of the Clean Air Act, the creation of the Department of Homeland Security, and the great budget compromise of the mid-90s. You are a leader today in No Labels, which we're going to talk about, and you are an author. And the book is, it's on the screen, The Centrist Solution, How We Made Government Work and Can Make It Work Again. And your timing is perfect because I think that's a question that millions of us all have. Welcome again, and let's get right into it, okay?
Thanks, John. Thanks for those kind words, and it's very good to be with both of you.
Well, great. Thank you. You talk about centrist and centrism. Help us understand, is it an ideology? Is it an absence of ideology? Is it just another form of pragmatism, an attitude? What do you mean when you say centrist, centrism?
Okay, that's a great place to begin, and I appreciate the question. Because a lot of people, I think, don't understand exactly what centrism is. I try to make the point in this book that centrism is not the same thing as moderation. Being a moderate doesn't necessarily mean you're a centrist. And here's what I mean. Centrism is really about people of different points of view, Republican, independent, Democrat, liberal, moderate, conservative, finding their way to a center point. You can call it common ground, to talk about a problem that the country faces, even though they have different points of view on it, and try to find common ground, negotiate, compromise, which I say in the book is not a dirty word. It's a way to get things done and then enact laws. So I would say, just to answer your question, it's a good one, directly, being a liberal or conservative or moderate is taking an ideological position. Being a centrist is more a strategy about how to make government work. And incidentally, it's always the way the American government has worked best. As I write in the book, going back to the original American governmental experience that worked, which was the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia. They had tremendous differences of opinion between big state, big population states, small population states about slavery. And they had to negotiate and compromise. Some of the compromises, looking back now, in the case of slavery, were morally unacceptable. But some of the others, how did they reconcile the difference between the big population states and the small population states? Somebody had the idea we should have two chambers and not one. One representing population, reflecting it, the House. The other, every state gets the same two senators, the Senate. So, and in all the cases that you were good enough to cite where I had the privilege of being involved in doing big things in Congress, they were all the result of bipartisan centrist solutions. That is the way it works best.
Thank you for that. I don't want to dwell on what is. As you do in the book, I want to dwell on what can be. But right, it's cyclical. I mean, we've had moments of bipartisanship. We've had moments of intense partisanship. no one really ever looks back at the moments of intense partisanship and says, wasn't it great that we had a civil war? Wasn't it great that a half a million people died? But how did we get to where we are right now, the hyper-partisanship? What happened?
Yeah, so you're right. This is not the first partisan period in American life and government, but people do seem to think it's the worst ever. Mm-hmm. And it's I don't know how you make a judgment like that unless you live through every one of them, which no one has, but it's really bad now. So how did we get there? We could spend all our time talking about it, so I'm just going to tick off the reasons. Obviously, the most immediately gerrymandering of House districts that make them basically one-party districts. So the Democrats are worried, once they're in office, about a challenge from their left. The Republicans are worried about a challenge from the right. So they get risk-averse. They don't want to offend the party, and that makes it impossible for them today to go to the middle and achieve a central solution. There's too much money in politics, way beyond anything I even imagined when I started in politics. And, you know, most of that money is not what I'd call philanthropy. It's either tied to a special interest or it's tied to an ideological interest, which the member of Congress who gets the money is expected to respect when they get in office. The media have become much more partisan over the years, and that encourages the same among people in elected office. So, I mean, those are big reasons why it's happened. I will say something else now. Didn't have to happen this way. There are obviously, we're living in a time when big changes are going through our society. So the most obvious, I suppose, is the digital revolution, the technological revolution. A lot of people are worried that they're not going to be able to make the same money that they made before. In fact, they're not making the same amount of money now that they made before. They're being replaced by machines, high-tech machines. So that makes them unsettled. There's been a tremendous cultural change in our country. I mean, when I was a kid, which isn't yesterday, we had something on TV called the Family Hour. Mm-hmm. In the movies, there was something I think called the Hays Code. This was an attempt to apply standards to the entertainment culture that protected kids, really. And parents could let their kids go to the movies or watch television during a family hour. That's all gone. I think it went as a result of cable TV. Look, I'm not anti-cable TV. They've given us a lot that we didn't have before, but it's also changed cultural values. And why do I mention this here? Because I think it's really unsettled a lot of people in the country, and they begin to suspect people on the other side of that divide. And they're also subject to the more extreme ideological appeals from left and right about what can make this all better and return them to a time that they were much more comfortable living in America. So it's very complicated, but notwithstanding everything I've said, if people put the country first, and sit down and talk to each other, not as enemies, but as fellow Americans, they can work out the problems and get something done. And that would reduce the anxiety and insecurity among the American people.
You've explained perfectly an anxiety-ridden perfect storm, all of these, you know, converging all at the same time. I'm generally the optimist in the room, so it's good to meet another and talk to another. So you're with No Labels.
Yes.
I'm familiar with it. I've read your book, of course. But tell us a little bit about the origins and the status. I'm sure that you cite some numbers about in the book about No Labels and, you know, it's rising support. But give us an update, too. First of all, how did it get started and where is it?
Yeah. Thanks for that question, John. It's an interesting story, actually. It starts with one person. Often that happens in American Life. Her name is Nancy Jacobson. I knew her a little bit earlier. She spent a lot of her career working in Democratic politics. She worked for President Clinton in the 92 campaign. She raised money for Democratic candidates. Probably the one she worked on with most was Evan Bayh of Indiana, who was and is a real centrist. But when we got to 2009, and she watched the very partisan reaction to the recession of 2008, which really had hurt a lot of people, she decided, you know what, maybe it's time to try to, for her to leave the partisan fundraising and try to set up an organization that will try to bring people together in both parties to get something done. So she came to me at that time and I really urged her on. But I was in the Senate, so I didn't do much but give her moral and verbal support. The organization started in 2010. And at the beginning, it basically, this is how sad you might say things were. Her goal was to try to get Republicans and Democrats in Congress in the same room together, because they weren't doing that very much anymore. And then No Labels began to develop policy ideas, and then they did polling on them. And when they had ideas, policy ideas that were supported by a majority of Democrats, independents, Republicans, they would advocate that to members of both parties. So it began to take hold a little bit, but a real turning point was in 2016 and then 2018 when No Labels, and I became chair in 2014, I guess, national chair, after I'd left the Senate, No Labels decided, you know, this is about politics. This is about the fear that a lot of incumbents of both parties have that when they go to the center, they're going to lose political support and financial support. And we've got to not only urge them to be centrists, we've got to put our money where our mouth is and make sure they know that we have their back if they get threatened by their party or some interest group to take contributions away. So we started to do that and continue to work on the policy ideas. And beginning in 2018 in the House, there was a formation of a bipartisan House Problem Solvers Caucus. No Labels encouraged it. We worked with them, but then it took off on a life of its own. It adopted what they call the Noah's Ark rule. You can only join by twos, which is to say one Republican, one Democrat at a time. It started out with about 22 or 24 members. They're up to 58 now, 29 of each party. In the Senate, it was a little harder to get it going. The natural suspects, Democrat Joe Manchin and Republican Susan Collins, formed something called the Common Sense Coalition. It grew to about eight, but then around this bipartisan infrastructure reform bill, which was started out in the House Problem Solvers Caucus, both parties worked side by side on it. They engaged with people in the Senate. Incidentally, here's a really, it could be sad, it could be encouraging. We had the idea, No Labels, to start doing bicameral meetings, breakfast, dinners. And you know, you'd be surprised at how little members of the Senate interact with members of the House. So out of these meetings, at one of the meetings, the House Republicans and Democrats said to the Senate Republicans and Democrats, you know, we're working on an infrastructure bill. Maybe we can work together. Well, that produced the bill that ultimately President Biden got involved in negotiating with House Republicans and Democrats, passed the Senate with 69 votes, including support from Chuck Schumer, the Democratic leader, and Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader. Should have just been swept through the House. It would have been good for everybody. But then the House so-called Progressive Caucus, the further left members of the Democratic Party in the House, blocked it. And as of this talking, they're still blocking it, even though most of them support it. So that's where we are. But it's a proud accomplishment for No Labels and our members in the House and Senate who are close to us. We're going to do everything we can in the 22 elections for Congress to protect the people who really had the guts to work together to get this kind of thing done. And hopefully we can. I mean, you know, in the last election, a lot of Republicans who had worked with us lost because Democrats swept the House this time. But we were able to replace those we lost with new centrist Republicans that came to the Problem Solvers Caucus. And I hope we can hold everybody that's there now who deserves to be reelected. If we can't, we're going to try to convince the new members to join us and each other in the center.
One final question from me. I know Jeremy has a few.
Sure.
You mentioned 500,000 signups for No Labels and college campuses. Where are we at today? Is there any difference?
I regret that I can't. It keeps going up. If I cited a specific number, in other words, it's greater than those two numbers. And that's kind of interesting because the assumption is that the campuses are either left or right, and mostly left. But there is a centrist group out there, and they're reacting against the extremes. It's like the general public. I mean, the noisiest political factions are the furthest left and furthest right. But any poll you look at, and you know this, John, people are generally in the center. They want people in government to work together, get something done. There's nothing particularly surprising about that. That's why they go to vote and elect people in the first place. Jeremy, it's all yours.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Dad. So you opened up with the probably the greatest example of a common ground centrist solution with the Great Compromise. And so that goes back to the founding fathers. Right. But in your lifetime, who did you draw inspiration from regarding centrism?
Well, that's really interesting. So we had a governor in Connecticut named Abe Ribicoff, who later became a senator. And I worked for him one summer in college. And then he became a sort of a mentor to me as I got active in politics and government in Connecticut. And he was a real centrist. When he was governor, I was only a kid then, so I can't say I was really following it, but I went back and read about it. He was elected governor as a Democrat, and the General Assembly, the legislature, was majority Republican. And his first big speech was called The Integrity of Compromise. And he said to the Republicans in the General Assembly, we could spend the next 2 years fighting each other along party lines, or we could compromise with each other and get something good done for the state. And that's what happened. I mean, the really catalyzing figure in my political life, which was true for many in my generation, was John F. Kennedy, then senator from Massachusetts, but then elected president, 1960, and a real Democrat, but not a look at now, his positioning on issues was really centrist. I mean, it was independent. So you might say he was progressive on domestic policy, like civil rights. He was quite moderate and pro-business on economic issues. I mean, supported a capital gains tax cut, for instance. And he was quite strong, and I guess you might say conservative, on foreign and defense policy. Of course, we were in the middle of the Cold War with the Soviet Union, but that's the position he took. And that Ribicoff and Kennedy both had that effect on me. Of course, during my adult life, as I got into politics, there were some great bipartisan partnerships. President Reagan and Tip O'Neill on Social Security reform, President Clinton and Newt Gingrich on a bunch of things, including most significantly the Balanced Budget Act of 1997, which I was privileged to be part of. So the great thing to say is that the Constitutional Convention, the Great Compromise, really is the initial standard for the centrist solutions. But you don't have to go too far back to find them in our history. And it should say to us that if there's a will to do this among members of Congress and whoever's in the White House, it can be done again on what seemed today to be the most intractable problems, like immigration, for instance, or criminal justice reform. And I hope we'll get back there soon before the country suffers more from basically a dysfunctional government and therefore an angry public that doesn't trust the government anymore. That's bad for our democracy.
So in your book, you've given this 360 view of how America has been assaulted with this hyper-partisanship. You can point to a pile of causes: the media, social media, the parties, the voters, the language.
Right.
And as a result, the issues become more intense because of all of that. And so here we are in 2021, and there are some really intense issues. And so you may or may not have the answer, and that's okay, but on some really intense issues, have you given thought as to what the centrist solution could be? I just want to rattle off two. The first one, okay, I think that's becoming increasingly on everyone's minds is Taiwan.
Yeah.
Do you have any insight on that regarding a centrist solution?
Yeah. Well, that's one that actually is, I think, open to a bipartisan agreement. Although the policy we follow is essentially a centrist policy, but it's got a tilt toward respect, I think, for the notwithstanding how big mainland China is, for Taiwan and what it's done in the last several decades, maybe it's seven decades now. I mean, Taiwan has done everything that America could have asked it to do. It's become really a democracy with human rights, and it's become a very successful market economy with some regulation of business where necessary. So I think, actually talking about polling, there was a really interesting article by somebody who follows polling, I guess in the New York Times in the last couple of days, about where are the people of Taiwan on this? And they seem to be at a center position, which is they don't want to be taken over by China. They want their independence, but they don't really want to make China so angry that there's a war. And I think we have an obligation to help them realize that, which is a sort of central solution. What do I mean? We got to state clearly, as President Biden fortunately has been doing lately to the Chinese, don't get any ideas about conquest over Taiwan. Figure out a way to live peacefully with them. And honestly, although there is strategic ambiguity, as they say, about this, give up on the idea of really making Taiwan just another province of China. It's just not going to be. But China can be better off by having peaceful and good relations with Taiwan. Incidentally, the level of business interaction between Taiwan and China is vigorous. Mm-hmm. And I remember once during some conflict between the two countries at the political, diplomatic level, I met with a couple of business people from Taiwan in my office in Washington. So I said, how's this diplomatic conflict affecting business? Oh, not at all, not at all. We're just, but people on both sides, just, that's the politicians. We're gonna do business with one another. Well, that's encouraging, and the Chinese ought to be reminded of that, because those business contacts with Taiwan are good for the mainland as well.
Yeah, I have to say that's the first time, and this is amazing, so simple. That's the first time I've heard someone say, what do the Taiwanese people think? So that,
yeah.
Thank you for saying that. Part B of the question, and then I'll move on to one other question. Of course, so we talked foreign policy, so we'll come back home, is vaccine mandates. Now, make no mistake about it. One could be totally objective, and they should, and say you've got federal overreach, you've got state overreach. What Governor Abbott is doing on the other side is a microcosmic example. Has your organization given any thought as to a centrist solution on that?
Yeah, I mean, I must say we're mostly involved in process and strategy. I can't say that that doesn't lead us to particular policy positions. But so the organization hasn't, as far as I know, said anything about the vaccine question. I think when you come to public health, the government has a responsibility to take action that science tells us is good for public health. I've been through this a lot as a state senator, as attorney general in Connecticut, as US senator. And on this particular question, I think vaccine mandates are in the public interest and in the interest of the health of the American people. And so you've got to really compel people to do it. Now, in any of these provisions, there are always exceptions. For instance, if for some reason that have been upheld by courts, that people have some sort of religious belief that, means that according to their religion, they shouldn't be forced to take a vaccine they don't want to take. The courts have sometimes said that can also go to a deep personal conviction that may not be classically religious, but is the equivalent of that for that person. But, yeah. You know, as you know, and others have said, right now we have a bunch of vaccine mandates, particularly for infants. And we do it because it protects their health. Everybody has a baby, or in my case now a grandbaby, knows that they get shots early in their life to protect them from things like measles and all the rest. And thank God they do, because it's allowed them to live through their childhood and well beyond. So I don't know if that's probably more to one side than centrism, but it's one side with an exception according to the rule of law.
Sure. And I think your state, if I'm not mistaken, I think Connecticut still upholds the religious exemption. One more question for me.
Sure.
Am I right on that, though, with Connecticut?
I think so, but I couldn't swear to it today. Yeah. I think that's right.
Okay, this one. I guess we're coming full circle here. Whether it's in your lifetime, whether it's in my lifetime, because we talked about the center solution and we talked about the Constitutional Convention.
Right.
Do you think that it's possible and could it get to a point that it becomes in the best interest that we see a second constitutional convention?
Well, how interesting. Well, it could help, but I think the odds are really against it, because people on both sides are nervous about what would happen at a constitutional convention. For instance, all my concern about the amount of money in politics these days, well, the so-called Citizens United decision of the Supreme Court really took off a lot of limits on fundraising. So most people will tell you, you know, states can affect this by adopting public financing laws. The federal government could do it too, but really the way to do it is a constitutional amendment. But will it ever happen? I doubt it though, but would there be a constitutional convention? I think people would be nervous about what might happen. But you know, every 225 or 30 years, probably not a bad idea. Remember Jefferson said, and I quote him at the end of the book, that every 20 or 25 years, every political system needs a good revolution as much as nature needs storms to clear away the roughage. So this country is so disappointed in our political leadership and so divided that, in my opinion, if the two parties don't figure out a way to move to the center, where most of the people are, even though they're not as loud as the people on the left or right, it's not that there'll be a revolution, although what happened at the Capitol on January 6th looked like it, and in some ways was by a small group. It may be that something that's not happened in our country since 1856, 1860, that there'll be a third party. And in a given year where the Republicans go too far to the right, Democrats too far to the left, who's to say? That may be the revolution that takes the place of another constitutional convention. Hey, it's been great to be with you both. Really.
Thank you very much, Senator. At the very beginning, I asked you to define centrist. I define centrist as a person who was the Democratic nominee for vice president, came within a hair of becoming the Republican nominee for vice president, and then was reelected to a fourth term as an independent. The book is The Centrist Solution, How We Made Government Work and Can Make It Work Again. It is available on Amazon and everywhere. Thanks so much for taking time.
Thanks to you, John and Jeremy. All the best. Thank you for a good discussion.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.